call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:36 p.m. on Tuesday, January 23rd. We have with us today Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Snap, Representative Palm, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cronk, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Foster, myself, Co-Chair Johnson. We have our LIO moderator today is Emily Mesh, and we have our committee secretary, Leah Frazier. Today we will hear a presentation on savings, reserves, investment funds by the Department of Revenue. And here to present in the room today, we have Pam Leary, Treasury Division Director for the Department of Revenue, and Zachary Hanna, the Chief Investment Officer for the Department of Revenue. And we have, I believe we have Commissioner Crum online. Yes, we do. If we have any questions for him. So, members, you may feel free to ask questions as we move through the presentation, although we may change that up as the meeting progresses. And Ms. Director Leary, if you would like to come forward, place yourself on the record, and go ahead and proceed with your presentation. Welcome to House Finance. And we have been joined by Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pam Leary. I'm the director of the Treasury Division. And with me today is Zach Hanna, the Chief Investment Officer. And I believe that the commissioner may want to start us off.
All right.
If he is there and can hear us.
Commissioner Crum, are you online, and would you like to say a few words to get us started?
Yeah, thank you so much, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Appreciate the committee having us back to talk about these numbers and the investment forecasts we have going forward. I apologize for not being there due to some of the weather issues. I wanted to make sure I wasn't caught on a rerouted flight, and I made sure that I was available to dial in and answer any questions. I'm going to let my staff take over and take lead throughout the presentation, but I am available, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for the time today.
All right. Thank you. Well, the weather, I guess that's a pretty good excuse. All right. Thank you.
Great. On slide two is our agenda. First, we will introduce you to the teams in Treasury that manage the investment funds and manage cash flow, and then we will do a deeper dive into both areas. Moving to slide four, we have a chart that shows four of the sections in the Treasury Division. The bottom right quadrant is in teal, and that's the cash management section. The remaining three sections deal with the investments. We have 40 professionals that work in these sections with strong longevity. Many of our staff have professional designations, such as CFAs, or Chartered Financial Analysts, like CIO Hannah, and CPAs, or Certified Public Accountants, like myself. Managing numerous investment funds and cash flows is complex, and so we're happy to have many professionals in our team. The box in red shows what we'll call the front office. It's where the portfolio staff invests the assets for state fiduciaries. The team oversees 57,000 trades annually, develops asset allocations and investment policies on behalf of hundreds of state accounts that roll into 48 investment funds, utilizing 32 investment pools, supported by 150 external and internal investment managers and 600 private equity funds. Quite a bit. The green box is the accounting and operations side of the house, or the back office, which ensures that all trades and costs are directed and accounted for in the correct accounts and funds. The purple box in the lower left is the middle office. They perform 160 compliance tests on trades every single day, and they also calculate performance for 30 state funds. Cash management processes 100,000 transactions annually that support the revenue and expenditures in the accounting system. They oversee all of the cash flow into and out of the state and ensure that the general fund has sufficient balances to pay our bills. Cash management also coordinates with the investment team daily to maximize our invested cash amounts. Moving to slide 5. Treasury currently manages $50 billion in assets for 48 funds. The last fund in the chart show the retirement funds that are managed for the Alaska Retirement Management Board, or ARM Board. There are actually 18 different funds that roll up into the $41.5 billion amount shown. The ARM Board has the highest risk tolerance of this group and has a well-diversified asset allocation that we'll discuss later in the presentation. The remaining fund groupings in the chart are state funds, and they're ordered based on their risk tolerance. Over half of the assets managed by the Treasury Division are directed or traded internally by our portfolio team. Treasury meets with the ARM Board and the State Investment Review Board quarterly to review investment results, asset allocations, and policies. In addition to getting briefed by consultants and investment managers, there's a 3-person investment advisory committee that provides independent viewpoints based on their respective investment backgrounds. The Treasury's work is mission critical, and we are fortunate to have a team that has provided excess returns, cost savings, and error prevention.
Just on that chart, the Illinois Creek Mine, just because it stands out, I don't know what that is. Can you tell me what that is?
Sure, Chair Johnson. That is a fund that contains money that was given upon bankruptcy of a mine that the state has to manage, and it will be used for mine reclamation for that particular fund.
Where is that in the state?
Sorry to say, I don't actually know exactly where that is, but I can get that information to you.
I think it's in the YK Delta near Flat. It's sort of in the heart of the YK Delta, I think.
Well,
there's a long history for that. And there were multiple parties that changed hands to get the money for the mine reclamation. But
that was money that was already deposited. That was already like on deposit for reclamation of the site at the closure of the mine, so to speak. And then the mine maybe transferred hands. Is that what's happened?
I think the management company transferred hands. There was bankruptcy that was involved. Yeah. And as payment through the bankruptcy, the money was received by the state. And so the state has that money ready to use. And I believe that there's a schedule for using that money.
All right. I just know this I'm just curious if we make sure we get the reclamation done that we're supposed to do. A lot of times that's always a challenge no matter what. Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. On that same one, I had highlighted it, but I would be curious to know what's the date at which either reclamation is completed or there is excess in the fund that can be used for either other mine reclamation or go to the general fund. So you'd said it's a long history. I assume that at some point we have a reclamation plan that says we're done. I'm just curious if we are still needing $1 million from reclamation or we're $1 billion from reclamation.
If would you bring back to the committee just some general information, a thumbnail overview of what is happening with that so we understand a little more of the long history or maybe the future history? A little bit? Thank you. Any other questions on this list besides, does anyone else have any questions on just so we... Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, so there I see 2 school funds. Can you just real quick, we have the Public School Trust Fund of $779 million and then the Education Endowment of $1.3 million. Could you just real quick give us a little information on that?
Sure. So Zach Hanna, Chief Investment Officer for the Department of Revenue. Public School Trust, we'll be covering most of the larger funds as we go through the presentation, so we'll be covering that in some detail. That fund, obviously a sizable fund, does support the education formula. And the education endowment is effectively a raffle that was set up a number of years ago. And that right now does not have is growing in size. As you can see, it's a small fund. It does.
Yeah, and I'm happy to wait till you have the further in the presentation. Thanks.
All right, very good. Thank you. Moving on.
Okay, so thank you, Director Leary. As I mentioned, Zach Hanna, Chief Investment Officer for the Department of Revenue. Start on page 6 here. This is an executive summary of information I'll be covering shortly, so I'm not going to go through all the details now. Overall, 2023 was a strong year for the funds Treasury manages. Director Leary and I have the good fortune to work with really a great team of professionals that take a lot of pride in generating strong results for the state. You'll see returns have been well in excess of peers and benchmarks and have meaningfully added to state assets and revenue. Team does this in part with a focus on lower cost asset management, with total costs well below that of peers. That'll turn to a discussion of capital markets and our detailed investment results on the next slide. So page 8 has general capital market performance information. As everyone is quite aware, the past few years have been incredibly volatile. This period includes the pandemic, with high fiscal and monetary stimulus and near zero interest rates. This led to significant inflationary pressure, with inflation peaking at just over 9% annualized in June of 2022. The Federal Reserve response to this has been strong, with short-term interest rates increasing to over 5%. This was challenging for both stocks and bonds in 2022. And now inflation has come down to more reasonable levels, and in 2023, capital markets rebounded. As you can see in the chart on the right, which rank orders benchmark returns by asset class for each year, performance for 2023 was all positive across these asset classes. It was led by a 26% return for U.S. equities, and on down through the list to roughly 5% returns for core fixed income and cash due to higher yields. So this is the backdrop for 2023 returns that we'll go through now by fund. Before we do that, page 9 goes through the performance of the asset classes that we manage for non-retirement state portfolios. These are all commingled investment pools that we use in different proportions to construct portfolios for the state that are efficient, that are low cost, and that are highly liquid. We manage the majority of these internally and focus on delivering market returns with some consistent upside, but limited downside. In the table on the right, the top section has the total performance by asset class, followed by a section with benchmark performance, and then finally performance relative to that benchmark. All of these numbers are through December of 2023. As you can see, returns were strong in the top section, with cash and bonds ranging from 4 to 8%, and equities from 10 to 26%. These returns added over $300 million of income and gains during 2023 to these funds. In the bottom relative section, the results were also strong overall. For state portfolios, more than 80% of the assets are in the first three categories, from cash through core fixed income. These are all internally managed and produce consistent excess returns over time, and the team did particularly well last year. For FY23, total excess returns for internally managed accounts across the onboard and state assets added $90 million in value over benchmark returns. So with that, we're going to transition to talking about the larger funds, and both Director Leary and I will switch off talking about fund and then talking about investment performance and the asset allocation for each fund. So with that, let me hand it back to Pam.
Again, for the record, Pam Leary, Director of the Treasury Division.
Just a moment. We have a question for Representative Stanton.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. through the chair, to our wonderful folks at Revenue. So I just have a quick question on your equity allocation for REITs. You know, typically REITs are pretty high dividend paying investments. So when we're looking at the total performance or even some of the previous year losses, are we concluding, again, the high dividend payouts that they made into that, or is that just the base of the investment itself?
Through the chair, so the REIT performance that you're looking at is the total return, including both appreciation and the income component. Mm-hmm. And as folks are probably pretty well aware, the real estate market has been fairly challenging, And so as you look across those equity returns from U.S. through global and including REITs, you know, the REITs returns for last year are the lowest of those, and that's because in particular commercial property has had a challenging time with the increase in rates and coming out of COVID with occupancy.
Yeah, quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair. So my guess would be, and of course the reason I'm asking the question is I'm sure you guys are responding accordingly to the kind of shift in that market with higher really interest rates and stuff like that on commercial risk. So
through the chair. So REITs is a small part of the state portfolios. As we go through the asset allocations, you'll see that it's only used in the larger kind of endowment style funds, and it's generally a 5% allocation in those funds. And by far the smallest allocation across. It's about 1.5% of total assets for the state funds. So fairly small. It's utilized primarily for diversification purposes. And we think especially, you know, given the performance that we've seen, you know, to date over the last couple of years, you know, we're comfortable maintaining that allocation, given that we've had a period of fairly poor performance. We think REITs are priced reasonably at this point, and again, that income component is fairly attractive as well.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This might be as good as anywhere for me to slip in my question. The PC endowment was moved over to the Permanent Fund Corporation vis-a-vis a bill that was passed last session, but can you talk maybe a little bit about whether that transition has been complete, when it was, and so on?
Sure. And so I'm happy, I think probably the best place to cover that, I'm happy to cover it now if you'd like, but we have two slides on PCE,
okay.
And I'll cover that transition, I think, in detail. And if you have remaining questions, certainly happy
okay,
to
well,
do
thank
that.
You.
But I guess in short, that transition occurred at the end of last fiscal year and was a successful transition.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question. I'm sorry, maybe I've already asked it, but a question about Callan. As I remember, did they work for the legislature and moved over and working for the administration, or they've had the retirement fund investments advise, you know, they've been the advisor for, I'm trying to remember their relationship with us, I guess, if you would enlighten us.
Certainly happy to cover that. So from a treasury perspective, Callan is the consultant to the Alaska Retirement Management Board.
Yeah.
They are not a consultant on the non-retirement state assets that we cover. So the ones that we're talking about now, they aren't a consultant for these assets, but they are a consultant to the ARM board, which is, you know, roughly, again, 80% of the assets we manage overall. And so the ARM board goes through an RFP process periodically. That process is occurring this year when they look to hire an investment consultant. And Callan has been a successful recipient of that RFP for quite some time. You know, I think at this point, you know, certainly well over 10 years and probably well over 20 years. They're also a consultant to the APFC. And so that's
yes.
Why they have a number of different distinct relationships with the state. But from our perspective, they're an ARM board consultant, not a state retirement consultant. And then I think you have APFC presenting later this week. Callan is a consultant to APFC, and often Callan has reported to the legislature mm-hmm. since they do have those two meaningful relationships with the mm-hmm. state.
Thank you.
Again, Pam Leary, Treasury Director. And before I start, I'd like to share that the Illinois Creek Gold Mine is located approximately 51 miles south of Galena. And we'll be happy to give you a whole write-up about the mine and where it's at, how it's been used, etc. On slide 10, we will discuss the savings reserve funds. The blue part of the chart shows the fiscal year end balance of the main fund of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The fund was created in the Constitution in 1990 when voters approved adding Section 17 to Article 9 of the Constitution of the State. All money received by the state after July 1st, 1990, through resolution of disputes about the amount of certain mineral-related income, must be deposited into the CBRF. The yellow area of the chart shows the amounts of the sub-account of the CBRF, which the legislature created in 2000. In accordance with AS 3710-430, money in the sub-account will be invested to yield higher returns than in the main fund, and utilizing the subaccount is limited based on the assumption that those funds will not be needed for at least 5 years. In 2008, $4.1 billion was deposited into the subaccount and was managed to achieve a higher return than the main fund. And in April 2015, that balance was returned to the main fund when it was determined the fund would be needed within 5 years. The legislature may, under certain circumstances and conditions, appropriate funds from the CBRF to fund the operations of state government with a simple majority vote, and that's when the amount available for appropriation is less than the prior year. Otherwise, appropriation requires a three-quarters of a vote. The green area represents the statutory budget reserve, or the SBR fund, created in 1986. And it was part of the Jafonzi, which we'll talk about pretty shortly, before and after being managed as a separate fund from 2013 to 2015. But we're showing it here to show all of the reserves together so you can get an idea of the magnitude of them. At June 30, 2023, the balance of the CBRF was $2.6 billion, and the SBR had $400 million in it. And I'll turn it to slide 11 to go over some statistics with Zach.
Okay. Again, for the record, Zach Hanna, CEO for Department of Revenue. Before I go through the CBRF on page 11, let me summarize the process that Treasury uses to set state investment policies and asset allocations. As Dr. Leader mentioned, we do have a formal state investment review with the commissioner and an independent investment advisory committee using some of the same process that we follow for the ARM board. We review capital markets and performance for each fund quarterly. At least annually, we review capital market assumptions and select asset classes for investment. And we go through each fund and set the appropriate investment policy and asset allocation. This is done in a transparent fashion with meeting packets and summaries available on our website. With that, I'll turn to the CBRF. CBRF has a low risk tolerance since it can be used as an emergency reserve during times of cash flow uncertainty. This fund has a potentially short time horizon and needs high principal protection. It's invested in 100% cash equivalents. And 2023 was a good year for short-term investments like the CBR, with the increase in interest rates. The one-year performance was 5.39%, beating the benchmark by 41 basis points. And for clarity, a basis point is 1/100th of a percent. So 41 basis points is 0.41%. So I'll be using that a number of times throughout the presentation. I want to make sure that people are tracking that. Any questions on the CBR before we move forward?
Madam Co-Chair. Just to get a sense that there's a lot going on, I'm going back to slide four, and you don't need to go back, but just that reading that 100,000 transactions annually, you got 40 employees, you must have a lot of inflow and outflow, I would imagine, right? All the state departments, and because this is sort of our buffer, our cushion, our working capital reserve, as I understand it, and just, I guess, a nod of appreciation for all the work you do.
Certainly appreciate it. And so both the general fund proper, which we'll cover next, and the CBR certainly are subject to potentially a high volume of cash transactions over the course of the year.
All right, we have a couple of questions, one from Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Hannon.
Through the chair for Mr. Hanna. Mr. Hanna, can you explain the growth in the CBR spanning the last essentially year? I know that we didn't draw from the CBR this past fiscal year, I believe. And I know that there's going to be some excess or surplus that'll come in, but we haven't done that yet, I think. I'm just surprised by the growth of the CBR there.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there was the sweep that occurred in the prior 2 years without the reverse sweep happening. And there also was a surplus that did get moved back into, I believe the total was about 1.5. The Division of Finance and the Department of Administration has most of the details, but it was through movement of funds that are now residing in the CBR permanently.
So for example, as to the sweep, when the previous balance of the Higher Education Investment Fund was swept, which was about $400 million, that would account for $400 million the 2.7 billion. Is that an example of?
That is an example, but I believe, and then the higher education was refinanced essentially. But yes, there are a lot of smaller funds as well that got swept and did not get put back into the smaller funds.
Thank you.
Representative Hamill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. Does Treasury have an opinion or a formula as to how much money should be kept in CBR fund for liquidity, for cash flow? We hear it talked about from Ledge Finance and from ONB, but I'm wondering from, you know, is there a rule in accounting and financial investment of how much we should have there?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, there are various types of metrics that cities, states, other government types of organizations utilize for the amount of money that you should keep in a rainy day type of fund. We have had the gamut of $500 million, $1 billion, $2 billion, and more be cited for various reasons over the years. We certainly think, based on the history of the fund, that the $2 billion mark is a good mark, but we don't have an opinion beyond that. I know that this is a question that the legislature discusses often, and how much money we need for the future year's cash flow.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Commissioner Crum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Commissioner Crum. I appreciate that question through the Chair, Representative Hannon. This is an item we're going to continue to address. In the previous slide, it did show the sub-account structure, which the Commissioner of Revenue does have discretion to invest. And this is an item that's brought up before Senate Finance. We'll talk with you. We're having internal discussions about it as we continue to grow the CBRF. At what point is it appropriate to actually put dollars forward into the sub-account to invest for the long term, a little bit higher of a risk tolerance, and hopefully have a little bit greater return? So this is internal conversations are going on that as we have, and you'll learn a little bit more on cash flow items when they get into the general fund issue. I just want to add it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Great. Again, Pam Leary. Slide 12 shows the historical. They're not hysterical. They're just historical. Balances of the two Jafonzi accounts. And Jafonzi, if you recall, is the acronym for the General Fund and Other Non-Segregated Investments. The name is maybe hysterical. The General Fund itself, which I think of like our checking account for the state, that is part of the Jafonzi. All cash flows that come in and go out of the state go through the general fund proper. And we keep a minimum floor of $400 million in the general fund to ensure we have enough funds to make our payments. And I'll talk a little bit more about that process later in the cash flow part of the presentation. There are about 180 other accounts and funds that have assets in the two Jafonzi accounts, and they're managed together, but they're accounted for separately, all the different accounts. The first Jafonzi was created in 1992 as a way to pool accounts for investments, and then the Jafonzi 2 was created in 2018 to target a slightly higher risk return for a subset of the funds. As of June 30th, 2023, there was $3.27 billion in the Jafonzi funds combined, and 1.2 of that was the general fund proper.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Leary, during the years where we were at high oil prices for a sustained period, sort of 07 to 12, why were we leaving money in the general fund and not? I know that there was a great effort, successful one, to put money in the CBR, and that's now theoretically, more than theoretically, what we owe. Why was all this money left in the general fund that's shown here?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe that that was the purview of the legislature's actions to decide where to maintain the money. And obviously, it was not put into the CBR during that time.
Thanks.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I think I just heard the commissioner refer to the CBR and the fund balance, and I'm just curious to know if there's an opinion about what balance would be needed to allow the sub-account to be funded, if there is something that you've landed on with regard to an opinion there.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. Again, this is something that is being discussed, but there is that five-year usage requirement for any funds that go into the sub-account.
Right.
So unless there is money that we know won't be touched or needed for future years, the money would stay in the main account until we see that we won't need it for 5 years. Obviously, each of the sub-account and the main account have their own asset allocation, so that's something else that is a matter of discussion.
Okay. Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm through the chair. I'm going to kind of follow up on my colleague's question that she just asked. We are looking at the CBR being utilized in 5 years based on a certain tolerance of risk windows based off our revenue factors, right? We know what our revenue factors are, so you should be able to kind of come to some sort of balance number off the top of my head, maybe $6 billion, $7 billion in the CBR before you would switch back to that fund where you could comfortably kind of say, hey, we're not going to utilize these funds. But then again, you're dealing with the legislature, right, who does a bunch of crazy things. So I guess could you help us out here? Is there any type of ballpark number that you could give us at the Finance Committee table or not?
Chair, Representative Stapp, I think part of the equation, I won't go into the whole detail of the ERA transfer, but we know the total amount that's coming, but we just don't know what amount is going to the general fund each year. I think we have a lot of uncertainty around whether money will be available mm-hmm. to the general fund and whether we would have to call money out from either the ERA or the CBR, et cetera, to make sure that we pay our bills.
All right. Thank you.
At this point, before giving it over to CIO Hannah, I'm going to just mention the appendix in the back of the presentation. It's a listing of the top 30 funds in both the Jafonzi 1 and the Jafonzi 2. In case you're interested, there are a lot of accounts and funds in there that have names you will recognize. I just wanted to mention that they're there in case you're curious.
So CIO Hannah, I'm going to cover page 13. So the risk profile for Jafonzi 1 and Jafonzi 2 are on the moderate higher end of the low risk spectrum. So these are both low risk funds, but higher risk than the CBR. Both funds do have a short-term investment horizon, and principal protection does need to be high. Jafonzi 1 is 85% cash equivalents, 15% short-term bonds. Jafonzi 2 is 61% cash equivalents, 33% short-term bonds, and 6% equities. The performance was good for both funds last year. Jafonzi 1 had a return of 5.34%, and Jafonzi 2, 6.22%, both well in excess of benchmarks. Any questions on Jafonzi 1 or Jafonzi 2 from an investment perspective?
Seeing none, proceed.
Thank you. Pam Leary. Slide 14, the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. We have the historical balances on slide 14. The fund was capitalized with a $400 million deposit from receipts of the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation, and it's used for paying Alaska Performance Scholarship Awards, as well as Alaska Advantage Education Grants. And up to 7% can be appropriated for scholarships. And of that amount, two-thirds go to the Alaska Performance Scholarships and one-third to the AEG Grants. In Fiscal year 2022, HB 322 established the Higher Education Fund as a separate fund, deeming it as a fund that could not get swept to the CBRF.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
So, through the chair, Ms. Leary, on the subject of sweeping to the CBRF, you mentioned the appendix, and I'm aware of, and I've read the cases, in fact, Judge Garton and others about the Higher Education Fund and how using the word separate is sort of magical. But I look at these large sums in these other accounts. Are these, how vulnerable are these accounts to the failure to reverse sweep this coming June 30th? Or will they all be essentially spent by our operating budget in large measure, if you know?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't know what component of these particular funds are sweepable. My understanding is a fairly small number. Mm-hmm. These funds tend to, some of them have balances that go off into the future. We've had them for a long time. And they get used over time. Some of them get replenished at the start of the year and get used for that particular year. But I'm not familiar with which ones of these are sweepable.
Okay, thank you.
Zach Hanna, on page 15, we're now turning to funds that have a long time horizon and a high ability to bear risk. The Higher Education Investment Fund is the first of these that we'll cover. We use a high risk profile for this fund to work to achieve the fund's spending objective, which is capped at 7%. We set the risk profile for this fund and others like it at the risk equivalent of 70% equities and 30% bonds. For last year, the full asset allocation was 39% U.S. equities, 25% international equities, 5% REITs, 30% core U.S. fixed income, and 1% cash. Performance over the past year was very strong at 16.45%, 55 basis points in excess of the benchmark. And as you can see from the chart, the 10-year performance was also fairly strong at 6.74% through a very volatile period. Any questions?
Slide 16 show the historical asset values for the Public School Trust Fund, which ended fiscal year 2023 with $761 million. The fund has been around since 1978 and is funded by 0.5% of the state receipts from the management of state lands, so mineral lease rentals and royalties. The fund is used to provide an offset to the K-12 formula funding. And for fiscal year 24, the fund contributed $32 million to the Public Education Fund and is expected to contribute approximately $35 million in fiscal year 25.
Zach Hanna, Department of Revenue. On page 17, the Public School Trust Fund also has a long time horizon. This fund has the same high risk profile as the Higher Education Fund. Performance over the past year was similar and strong at 16.43%, 53 basis points in excess of the benchmark, and the 10-year performance was 6.46%.
Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair. So I had a question on this one and the slide before. So my understanding of the Public School Trust Fund is that there is a lot of It's very, well, you said that it was a 5% draw, and that contributes to funding the formula, or it's a formula. But there are a lot of boundaries around that. There's nothing that says that we could take more out of that. Is there any avenue to access that account besides that 5% draw?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, I'm not aware of any other avenues for the money, although I do know that I believe in the past the legislature may have appropriated some funds out.
Okay. And Chair, can I have one follow-up?
Yeah, Paul.
The prior, I want the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. So I think that was capped at 7% that could be appropriated. And you may have to follow up on this, but when that 7% is appropriated, are all those funds being used for the scholarship grants? Do you know, do you pull the money out? And if that all that money's not needed, does it go back in, or do you only pull it out as needed?
Through the chair, Representative Kalum. The Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund has been used for the awards and grants in actually less than 7%. And so only that amount that they have issued in the past has been taken out. So the rest remains in the fund. And actually, I was confusing it. I believe this fund was used in the past for as the legislature appropriated some funds from the Alaska Higher Education Fund for use in other particular funds, not the public school trust. But I also know that there is a bill that exists to potentially increase the amount of the scholarships and the grants. And so we'll see if they hit that 7% going forward.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair.
All right, thank you.
The next two slides are on the Power Cost Equalization Fund. Slide 18 shows the asset balances through June 30th, which was $946 million. And as we talked about earlier, management of the fund was transferred to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation on July 1st via SB 98. So we'll be providing information on the fund only through June 30th.
Okay, so on Zach Hanna, Department of Revenue, on page 19, as Director Leary mentioned, PC was fully liquidated to cash for transfer at the end of the fiscal year. And so performance is only through 6/30 instead of 12/31 like the other funds that we're covering. Nonetheless, the fund had strong one-year performance through 6/30 of 9.59%. The team also worked hard to leave the fund fully invested for as long as possible during the fiscal year. So we managed to capture most of the market rebound that occurred during the first half of the year. And so you can see that we captured 9.59% of what was a 9.98% rebound during that portion of the year. That fund was 100% cash on the last day of the fiscal year and was transferred on the first or second day of the next fiscal year to EPFC.
Continuing on to slide 20, we have the assets for four of the funds that the ARM board is the fiduciary for: the pension and health defined benefit plans for the public employees retirement system, PERS, which is in blue, and TERS, or teachers retirement systems, which is in yellow. These funds total $29.8 billion at the close of last year. As closed funds, the defined benefit plans currently experience net withdrawals annually from the funds, and the board is comprised of 9 trustees, 2 from the PERS system, 2 from TERS, 2 commissioners, 2 public representatives, and 1 finance officer. Mr. Hanna will give you some updated results, but for 2023, investment returns for these funds were just over 7%. And the 39-year average for PERS and TERS was 8.95%, which compares favorably to the current actuarial assumed rate of 7.25%.
Representative Scott.
Yeah, through the chair and to the wonderful folks at Treasury. So, on the PCE fund, did you say that you had to liquidate all the assets of the fund? I turned them into actual cash and then transfer them. So my question is, why could we not just transfer the assets to the management fund? Why did we have to liquidate the assets? Because when I haven't seen the PC returns yet, but I would imagine they were going to be substantially reduced because they had to be liquidated and then turned into new asset classes and reinvested. So
Sure. So through the chair, so you can see the portion, our portion of that. So you're referring to obviously those assets were sold, and then they needed to be, new securities needed to be purchased by ATFC. And so really kind of two parts to that question. One is certainly APFC has a different asset allocation than the incoming PC assets. And so a lot of those assets would have to have been sold in any case to buy into the pools that APFC manages. And there are also lots of operational and legal complexities transferring securities between companies. And so it was the judgment in consultation with APFC, really of Treasury and APFC, that the operational challenges, really the cost and potential implications of those challenges outweighed the potential benefit of transferring those in-kind. In-kind transfers of this size can be quite challenging.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, Zach Hanna, Department of Revenue, on page 21, last but certainly not least, the state retirement systems represent, as I mentioned, roughly 80% of Treasury's assets under management. These systems do have a more complex asset allocation since they don't have the same liquidity requirements as direct state assets. They have meaningful allocations to less liquid alternative investments like private equity and real assets. The current asset allocation is 43% public equities, 21% fixed income, and 36% alternative investments. Returns have been strong. Here we tend to focus on longer-term returns, since having material allocations to alternatives can make shorter-term comparisons difficult or potentially misleading. The 10-year return has been 7.4%, 91 basis points over the benchmark return. Since I know it can be hard to connect with excess returns and basis points, we had a suggestion this year from one of the state's independent investment advisors to quantify that benefit in dollars, which does take some detailed analysis. So at fiscal year end, our middle office analytics team used 10 years of daily cash flow data on returns and cash flows to calculate how much additional value in assets these excess returns provided. It was well over $2 billion on systems that were roughly $20 billion in total size on average over this period. This was also a top quartile return when compared with peers, better than over 80% of other public pension systems. And as I mentioned earlier, part of this excess return can be attributed to the low-cost approach that Treasury employs. This has led to total costs that are roughly 30% lower than the median peer, saving $30 to $50 million per year consistently. So overall, strong returns from the ARM board have provided meaningful contributions to state to retirement assets and reduced the need for higher state contributions.
And I have to say that I think that's impressive. And would you say that not just this particular fund, but in general, is that why you have higher returns than the permanent fund?
So a good question. Returns between the retirement systems and the permanent fund have, over the long term, been fairly similar. So the long, Pam, Director Weaver mentioned that 39-year number. Those are very close. Some of the other longer-term numbers are close as well. We do have differing asset allocations. The funds certainly have a different purpose. In particular, the retirement systems are mature. They're closed. And they were becoming more mature over time. And so the liquidity requirement for those systems will increase as time moves on. And our ability to hold alternative investments will start to go down over time. And so you should expect to see returns differ kind of on an annual basis, which is what you have seen going kind of year by year. So some years our returns are higher. Some years their returns are higher. But both when you take a look at kind of peer comparisons and benchmark comparisons, I think both groups have done a very nice job of managing investments for the state.
Thank you. Representative Stapp.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. I'm sorry to monopolize the committee. Through the chair to the folks at our wonderful money investors who do so amazing. I can't help but think about how at this moment, the other body is debating a retirement system bill. That bill assumes a rate of return that is above our five-year average in our existing fund that you guys are managing. It is on target with the ARM board's rate revision. Of course, the board revised the rate of return down from 7.38% to 7.25%. My fear is that the rate of return from the board itself will be revised down again and thus cause problems with a benefit system. So I'm curious if you guys in your forecasting have seen anything on the horizon that would suggest we may be revising down our projected rates of return in the near future.
So through the chair, excellent question. So every 4 years, the ARM board goes through a process of setting actuarial assumptions, including that assumed rate of return. And so as folks can see in the slide here, you know, back in 2022, really what had been the longstanding expected return of 7.38% was revised downward to 7.25%. And these things, you know, these numbers tend to be influenced by kind of a backward look on performance. And certainly we had gone through a prolonged period of extremely low rates that, you know, really culminated with zero interest rates, you know, in 2021. But rates had been quite low really since the global financial crisis and had influenced expected returns and performance for quite some time. And I think you really saw that, you know, culminating in most public pensions reducing their expected rate of return, the ARM board being really no different. You're actually seeing a reversal of that to a large degree at this point. And so now we've gone from a period, you know, 2 years ago where we had zero interest rates on the front end of kind of the, you know, the yield curve, you know, now to, you know, interest rates that are over 5%. That really is providing a big uplift for most portfolios. And so, you know, this portfolio has 21% exposed to fixed income. You know, the expected return for that portion of the portfolio is now in excess of 5%. And that has, you know, those expected returns influence the other asset classes as well. And so my expectation, you know, we've seen capital market assumptions for this year already last week. So those are released this time every year by Cowen. We do use those for the ARM board. We tend to use those for longer term state assets as well, just for consistency. And we are seeing an uplift to those capital market assumptions. Our expectation for higher risk funds like the ARM board and like kind of those 70-30 endowments like Public Schools Trust is probably on the order of 25 to kind of 40 basis points of increase over a 10-year investment horizon. And so fast forward to the next time that the ARM board sets actuarial assumptions, you know, they're certainly going to, review, you know, capital market assumptions, review all the economic information, and set the best expectation that they can. There is no longer what had been a fairly steady decrease, an expected decrease in expected returns. You know, I now think we're effectively, you know, either bottoming out or, you know, there is some potential that you might see some uplift depending on what happens over the next couple of years. So sorry for the long-winded answer.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. This is a very general question. Earlier you mentioned the Treasury's low-cost methods, and I'm wondering if you could give me just kind of a broad description of what that entails.
Sure. So, through the Chair, excellent question. I would really kind of take that in two pieces. We have dedicated direct investment teams within Treasury, and so my specific group, we have a team that has managed direct fixed income investments for the state for decades now. That's a long-standing direct investments of cash portfolios and fixed income. And for state assets, that's, you know, the lion's share of what we're managing. We also have a dedicated equities group that manages direct investments on the equity side, largely for the retirement systems. And so that's one source of savings. We have, you know, a lot of scale with these systems. And we are able to do it ourselves at a much cheaper rate than outsourcing those investments with, frankly, better results by and large. And so the other aspect of that has been largely on the retirement system side, And again, kind of plays it. You know, that's an element of it. We have brought a lot of external management in house. We have also, on the equity side, moved away to some degree from what we would think of as active management towards more index oriented management, which is much lower cost, not necessarily higher return, but over the over the recent period has generally been higher returning as well.
Thank you.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, on this slide, or the previous slide, you said there's $29.8 billion in the PERS and TERS. On page 5 for the ARM board, it's $41.5 billion. So where is the discrepancy? Is there, where's the extra $11.5 billion? You're probably getting to that.
Through the chair, again, good question. And so this is, as Director Leary mentioned, kind of four of the what we think of as 14 retirement systems. That is one of the answers, but the largest answer is the defined contribution systems are close to $10 billion in assets now. And so that's the largest piece of like the 11.5 that you mentioned. So the roughly $10 billion of that is the participant-directed systems, including both PERS and TERS defined contribution, and the deferred comp and SBS plans. Those are, getting in round figures, getting close to $10 billion in size. The other $1.5 billion is a collection of other defined benefit systems, or what we think of as defined benefit components of the defined contribution plans.
And is there a slide on that?
We would certainly be happy to give you full detail. It's on our website, but we'll send the committee a full breakdown of all of those numbers.
Representative Josephson.
Just to clarify through the chair, Mr. Hammond, so when you talk about $10 billion for DC-related items, that's the employer's share that they're investing, right? I assume that's you're segregating the employee's contribution from that total.
So through the chair, that is, and so the number as of 12/31 was $9.4 billion in total in participant-directed investments. This is the asset value in participant-directed accounts at the end of the calendar year. So it includes both the employee and the employer contributions that have occurred through that date.
Okay. Representative Scout.
My last one. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair. So just curiosity. Are the consumer-directed accounts, their own decided rates of return, are they performing better than the non in terms of overall performance, or is it different materially? Or just curious.
So through the chair, I don't have that information, so I can't answer your question directly. So the default option for the participant-directed assets are what we think of as kind of age-appropriate target date funds, and the performance of those funds has been very strong.
All right.
Okay. This is the third part of our presentation. Again, Pam Leary, Director of Treasury Division. We're going to talk about the state cash flows. And on slide 23 is a depiction of our general fund cash inflows and cash outflows, and just a few examples of when you think of what the big items are that are coming through the general fund. Cash inflows, obviously, tax revenue, the earnings reserve funds that get moved over for the general fund and or for dividend payments, lots of federal dollars coming in as well, and any kind of agency receipts like fees and licenses, et cetera. A few examples of the cash outflows are the school education payments, payroll and pension payments, vendor payments, Medicaid payments, debt service payments, et cetera. And if you think about the cash management function, all of the money coming in and out of the state goes through the general fund proper. So So we'll discuss some of the cash inflows and cash outflows a little bit in greater detail. You saw the presentation on the revenue sources book, and the two biggest components, revenue coming in for the unrestricted general fund, is commodity or petroleum revenues, which for fiscal year 24 are projected to be 37%. Uncertainty exists with this particular type of revenue in year due to volatility of production, oil prices, et cetera. We'll always have in-year uncertainty of money coming in because the budget's based on in-year oil forecasted revenues. The other component that's large is the investment return, and that's about 56% of the unrestricted general fund for fiscal year 24. And we do have certainty around this year and next year's amount that's going to come into the general fund due to a lagging percent of market value from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Of course, after that, we have uncertainty again because we don't know what those amounts are going to be. But this allows a little bit more of consistency in knowing what funds are coming into the general fund to make payments. On slide 25, we talk about the impact of expenditures. Very often we'll have a need for cash outflows before we have money coming in to the general fund. An example of this is the federal programs. We are required to spend money before we can call money back in, such as Medicaid. We also have appropriations at the start of each year. And those monies have to go into different funds for different agencies to use them. And, of course, that doesn't match the incoming revenue at the start of the year. And we also have seasonal cash flow needs that impact the amount of money that is needed to go out of the general fund in each year, such as the summer peak season for seasonal workers, et cetera.
So one of the concerns that I've heard from some of the state contractors, construction and otherwise, and I don't really know who to I can think of some people to ask this of. But anyway, I had a number of people tell me that they are carrying the state at a level that they have never carried the state before, that they're not getting their invoices paid on time. And particular, one person told me, I said, well, how much is a lot? They said $18 million was what they had on their books at that time. And so, I mean, that's a lot of money to have a contractor carrying the state for. I don't think doesn't seem to be isolated, and I've heard that from more than one person, large and small numbers. Do you have any thoughts on what is going on? And, I would like to hear more, and I probably will look into that a little bit more. But, yeah.
Chair Johnson, our cash management group sees inflows and outflows kind of net. We don't necessarily, we see which agency is coming through. We don't necessarily know or dig in to the exact reason, like what bills are actually being paid. That's more of an agency-related idea, unless we're seeing something like not timely requesting federal funds. That's when we would get involved. So I don't have an answer on that. It's more, I think, an agency issue.
And while I hear what you're saying on that, it seems to me like, and I've heard, just talking to people, more than one agency involved having something similar as far as getting their receipts paid. And I want to make sure that it's not a systemic across all of our state payments, because that's what it feels like a little bit from just an empirical, from what I've heard from people. And I hope that we make sure that we pay people just in general on time is important. Anyway, I'll look into it further. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, it's a good segue, Ms. Larry. The For the second year or second January in a row, I've been visited by the 4-acre group, and they have expressed frustration with the fact that nonprofits are not receiving payment from grants, some of them directly through the federal government, some of them this legislature doesn't know about because they're just pass-throughs that happen without us, I guess. Apparently, the law says that if you're a for-profit vendor, I'm thinking of quality asphalt paving or something, and they don't get paid in time, they can charge interest and penalty to the state. There's a request for reform, and maybe this is way downstream of your agencies, I think is what you're telling us, that this is the next level of government at the department level that we should inquire with?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct. We're fairly agnostic in terms of money coming in and going out. We just make sure it goes to where it's supposed to go, and whether it's coming in or going out of the cash management section. We don't really have any levers that can stop payment unless somebody tells us that we need to stop a payment going out to a bank or coming in. And often we'll have general fund inflows that come in that we work with agencies if we don't have real good descriptors on the money coming in, where that money belongs. And we'll go into like a suspense account until we can work through where the money is supposed to go.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. I was wondering if you could walk me through FEMA payments, especially in relation to like wildfire mitigation. So, you know, this is a common ask in the supplemental. And so I'm trying to figure out how the money is handled. So are we putting out the money and then FEMA gives it to you and you pay it back into the general fund, or if you can enlighten me on anything around the FEMA money?
Through the chair, I will try. Representative Colom, the money that comes in from FEMA is most likely, and I don't know the exact details, but put into a fund for the purpose of paying out what it was meant to be paid out for. So that would then be under the purview of the agency that's overseeing the FEMA amounts that are coming in, which unfortunately I'm not really familiar with.
That's okay. So can I have a follow-up? Is that okay, Chair? Through the chair. So go ahead. Sorry. So you're saying that basically the department would put out the money and then the FEMA money comes in and gets set aside and then goes back to the department, basically? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
On to slide 26 to talk about cash flow deficiencies. So we're talking about when we have expenditures that are greater than the revenue coming in. And a lot of this flows out of the evolution of our accounting system and structure of funds. Way back when we had the general fund, and it was used to pay all kinds of different bills coming in for different agencies, which we still do, but now a lot of funds have been created to capture funds like the ones in the appendix for use in future or the current year. And so the general fund is somewhat constricted in terms of how much money is in the fund to pay our bills. And so we will have cash flow deficiencies throughout the year, and we manage those by adjusting the timing of the earnings reserve account transfer to the general fund for the last 5 or 6 years now, borrowing from the budget reserves or other funds, and managing timing of expenditures. And one that we have in the past is for the education payments. Historically, about 10 years ago, all the money went into the education fund for payments, but we worked with the department because they weren't using all of the money at once. And so we worked out a payment structure to maintain our cash flow, to have more consistency throughout the year by paying it quarterly. And so we'll do that with other expenditures just to manage what money we have and what we don't have. slide 27 is on revenue shortfalls. That's different from a cash flow timing deficiency. It's when we don't have sufficient revenue to cover all of the general fund appropriations in any given fiscal year. And we've had language in the operating budget annually that has appropriated budget reserve funds for revenue shortfalls, and the Treasury has relied on that appropriation to authorize use of budget reserve funds for both shortfalls and in support for cash flow timing mismatches. So we've had the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund some shortfalls in prior years, but not in every year.
All right, thank you, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My question is really just about the overall timing of all of this and the transfers. I appreciate in my home, similarly, I will transfer from my savings to my checking so that I'm sure to cover my bills. And in consideration of what we heard from Co-Chair Johnson about the construction industry and about FORCR and all of the issues around getting those payments out in time, I guess my question is, is there at all a question that the funds aren't there at the hands of the check writers? Is there a problem with that, or is it the problem that we haven't transferred the funds in advance enough for them to be in with the check writers, if that makes sense? Just, I don't know how often you're making these transfers and what the system is.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that is actually one of the main functions of the cash management group, mm-hmm. is to make sure we have enough money on hand to pay bills when they are needed to be paid. And we go through a series of, and I'll get to this on actually the next slide, we have a $400 million minimum cash threshold for the general fund proper, and that allows us to have enough money in case of a perfect storm of all of our major payments going out the door for 2 days. And so we maintain pretty close to that threshold, and anytime we see we might be going underneath that, we call for money from whatever source we have available. Of the $3.5 billion scheduled in ERA transfers this year, through January to date, we've called about 2.1 of that. Mm-hmm. And so we work with the Permanent Fund Corporation if we need to change the schedule, because we set the schedule at the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. And that's based on forecasted revenue coming in. And we also know about specific expenses that may be larger. And so we try to make sure we're monitoring that at all times. And that is a very important function because we never want to not have enough money to pay our bills.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I agree with that. And just as a commentary, we also never want to stop, important transactions that are taking place. $18 million is a lot of work and a lot of workers. So I hope that we can maybe somehow get to the bottom of that, Madam Co-Chair, and I'm not sure this may not be the right group to be asking the questions, but I look forward to further conversation. Thank you.
And so slide 28 is a discussion on the Memorandum of Understanding between the Departments of Revenue, Administration, OMB, and Law. It essentially lays out what that target is. It has changed over the years to be the $400 million minimum cash threshold, and outlines procedures for what to do to first make sure we have cash projections, we monitor what's going in and going out, we execute the appropriated transfers. If we need to borrow on a temporary basis, we do. And if we see that a revenue shortfall is coming, the first thing we would do is seek legislative action through the governor's office to access additional funds. And then if all else fails, we're going to start prioritizing the disbursements, which we do not do at all.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah,
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, you just said if you're going to, in case you had to borrow money, would that be like inter-fund borrowing, or do you have some kind of line of credit somewhere at some bank?
Through the chair, we do not have a line of credit. That was, I think, part of a legislative bill last year or the year before, I can't remember, as another alternative to accessing funds. But right now, we are limited to the earnings reserve account, the CBRF, borrowing from some of the sub funds that are like the sweepable funds we discussed earlier, and then just restricting cash payments out the door. We've never in the history have done that. We came close one time, I think, in the 80s, and that had to do mostly with an appropriation level that they had to allow a greater appropriation cap, which was done, and all the bills were paid.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you. Mine is slightly off script, Madam Chair. I'm looking to get an update. Last year, Commissioner was, when he was first here, the cannabis cash, that literal cash management update of, there was, Treasury was going to build some more secure facilities, I believe.
Let's go ahead and finish up. We've just got like a slide and a half left, and then maybe you can provide an answer to that question, or you can ask it again at the end there. Let's finish this up, and then we'll get to that.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Just a quick summary on page 29, that cash flow forecasting changes due to revenue and expenditures changing throughout the year. And even if we have a balanced budget, we can have timing mismatches throughout the year. And revenue shortfalls may occur if we forecasted incorrectly or had improper assumptions when making our forecast. And that concludes that section of the report.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. And Representative Hanner.
Yes. So I'm. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking for an update on, I know that we've had some issues about the literal cash that cannabis taxes are paid in, and the largest burden of protecting that falls to your department and division, and the commissioner, when he was newly appointed, said there was a plan. I think it involves some new safes, and I'm just looking for an update on that. Not the tax policy. That's a whole other discussion.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I don't actually have much of an update for you. I know that there was a, similar to what we have in Anchorage, a deposit or a depository and safes that were planned to be created. I don't know what the status of that is right now. So it's pretty much business as usual as in the past, as far as I know, unless the commissioner has an update. And it's really the tax division. They're perfume. Obviously, we get the money, but it's the tax division that oversees the collections.
So, through the chair, your understanding is still there's only one depository that we have cash coming into. And so all the taxis across the state are still having to transport that all to Anchorage.
Through the chair, that's correct.
All right. Very good. We have a question, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair to our wonderful Ms. Leary. So my question is on regarding the appendices on the PFD trust, the Geofonzi account PFD trust. Am I correct in assuming that that is the hold harmless funds?
Through the chair, Representative Staff, that fund is where the money goes when it comes over from the permanent fund corporation to pay dividends. It's housed there, and that's where the payments actually come from.
Follow up, Madam Chair. So I'm in our budget, we have a provision that takes permanent fund dividend revenue, i.e. earnings reserve account directed for permanent funds, and we take a section of that, and we pay what's called the hold harmless to backfill the Social Security Administration. So when we allocate that money from the dividend, our actual spend for that program is like $6 million below what we appropriate in our budget. So my question is, given the fact that that is like PFD fund source money that goes into the PFD trust account, what actually happens to that excess? Where does it default to, if that makes sense?
Through the chair, Representative Stepp, my understanding is the money just stays there and is used in the calculations going forward for the next year in terms of how much money goes to the fund.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation. We appreciate having you before us on our snowy day. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, January 24th, 1:30 p.m. Committee will receive a presentation from the Legislative Finance Division on the FY 2025 fiscal overview. And with no further business before the committee, our meeting is adjourned at 2:57 p.m.